Hello, welcome to Holm Village. Today is Friday, July 24th, 1998. In the Creekside room this evening is Mary Boys. Session number is 98-3 and is titled The Jewish Jesus. So what? Let's listen in.
And this is the third session in a two-week exploration of the theme, Has God Only One Blessing, which I probably really won't get to the theme too much till the end of next week. But anyway, I know many of you are moving on tomorrow. And tonight's session in particular is focused on what is the meaning and the significance of the fact that we simply say without too much troubling that Jesus is Jewish. What's the content to that? And what's the significance of that, and where have we sort of been in the church with this beforehand? What I'd like to do is to give some brief introduction to this, sort of set this up a little bit, both in terms of the topic itself, but also in relationship to the overall theme this summer of Guide Our Feet, and in particular the practices of Christian life. And this is a very primitive map that I've drawn on the board. Please don't copy it for yourself, or you'll have the impression that it's the scale or something, and then you'll look at a real map and I'll be sued. But anyway, I have a few factoids on the board, and that way I can kind of point to them just so that we can kind of keep things straight. I've done two other sessions that have dealt with some of the kind of the basic layout of the first century, and I don't want to repeat everything in those sessions. On the other hand, there is a way in which some of this builds. This is part of a long-term project that I have been working on in a book that will appear probably in about 15 months. So let me start with, I know you can't all read the board, but it makes it a little simpler for me. Someone can take the chair. There's two chairs in the front, the anxious seat for sinners. I would like to begin a bit by suggesting to you that many of us of a certain age, at any rate, and I think there are probably some people in this room over 21. At any rate, many of us grew up in Christian churches that taught us about Jesus by way of comparing and mostly contrasting him with Judaism. And involved with that was a disparagement or a caricature of the practices of Jewish life. Jewish practices were legalistic, or they were parochial, they were narrow or something. And it was Jesus who had the real practice, which became the practice of Christianity. And there are many remnants of that view in the church today. If you pay close attention to sermons, not here, but in other places, maybe you should pay close attention to sermons here, too. We have a short friendship.
Yes, that's right.
Real. But if you pay attention in many other places, then you hear some sort of surprising things, or even in prayers. I remember one time in the Eucharistic prayer for children, one of the versions, it simply begins, Jesus came into a world where people no longer loved each other. Now that's a fairly astonishing claim. It's also without any kind of empirical evidence. And it's a terrible thing to say about any people, let alone about Jews. So I call this sort of the Jesus versus Judaism point of view. Now, there are two kinds of variations, I think, on sort of an improved notion of this, but I will suggest that I don't think they go far enough. And there, one I call Jesus and Judaism. We sort of put Jesus here, but then we recognize that, well, he is Jewish, and there's one chair up here, there's one pillow sit on the floor.
Well, we can get some
chairs. The lotus seats are gone, but it's still a separation. It's as if somehow he exists outside of this context. Another variation on this is what you might call Jesus as the singular Jew. He's the one that, he is the, for instance, I'll talk a little bit about this tonight, or if we don't get to it tonight, I'll talk to tomorrow. Jesus calls God, Abba, Father, in the Gospel of Mark, in the account of the so-called agony at Gethsemane, agony in the garden. Now, much has been made of that in Christian circles in saying, well, this, because Abba is an Aramaic word that seems to be, at least some linguists thought it was a diminutive form of Father, more like Daddy, is very familiar, and that signaled that Jesus was so intimate with God, and then that became a huge superstructure on which we based all kinds of things about how Jesus was the one who corrected Jewish legalism, and he was the most intimate with God of anyone who's ever, you know. And the thing that I think I find very, besides the fact that linguistically it's a highly problematic claim, it makes intimacy with God into a competition. So one of the questions I sort of want to just lay out and for your own consideration, I think this can be somewhat challenging sometimes to us, is it necessary for us to think of Jesus as the one in the whole, you know, cosmos who is the most intimate with God, or can we reduce the competition and think of Jesus' intimacy with God as not somehow denying other ways and modes and forms of intimacy with God? In other words, not make it a quantifiable sort of reality. Now I can see some kind of grimaces and frowns, and so I'm not, you know, I realize I'm not trying in any way to take Jesus away from a center of Christian life, but I'm concerned sometimes how we talk about Jesus in relationship to his context, and that's what I would like to focus on tonight. So what I would like to suggest is that a healthier way that is truer to our origins in Judaism and truer to the complex nature of the Jewish world from which Jesus came is to ask, well, what's characteristic of Jesus of Nazareth, who was, after all, a first century Palestinian Jew? In other words, what aspects from Jewish life does Jesus emphasize? What things does he seem not to emphasize, and how might we then draw some conclusions from that? And it's not to say that some of the things that he preached and emphasized, for instance, care for the marginal, which is, I think, a major emphasis on the teaching of Jesus, it's not necessary to say, well, he's the only one in first century Palestine that emphasize this, but it is important to say, well, yes, this is one of the things that when we see in the Gospels, his emphasis on the inclusion of sinners and tax collectors. Those of you who were here on Monday, we talked about the Pharisees and this, you know, the group that he had with him as his table companions, a group that in some ways scandalized others of more narrow opinion, that we can say, well, this is a very strong claim to make about who Jesus was. But we don't, I think, have the right to say, well, he was the one in first century Palestine who cared for the marginal. So I'm trying to help us be more careful about this. So what I would like to do is to pick up a bit on the theme of practices tonight and talk about three practices that, when you read the Gospels, come across as, to a certain extent, Jesus over against Judaism. One of the reasons, by the way, that I think we have this Jesus versus Judaism is that the Gospels were written in a period where there was contention among Jewish groups. And so this versus notion, this contention, say, between Jesus and the Pharisees and so forth, it's in the text. We didn't, you know, just invent this. But what I'm trying to suggest is that the texts were already colored by the controversies of their day, and to try to see if we can get behind the text to the earlier period of the historical Jesus. Is that clear enough? I mean,
yeah.
Okay. So the practices I'd like to look at, and they're not, you know, the practices in the book Practicing Our Faith, I'm not trying to have a one-to-one alignment with them, because that's too difficult to do responsibly. But one of the practices that's emphasized in the book is Sabbath keeping, right? And so one of the questions that I'd like to explore tonight, well, how do we think of Jesus in relationship to the Sabbath? Another practice I'd like to have us look at, and if we don't, I would rather not try to get all of these done. You know, I'll stop at various points for questions and comments. If we don't get finished tonight, I'll finish it tomorrow night. What are we to make of worship in the temple, offering of sacrifice and so forth? And then third practice in Judaism, very foreign to us in the Western world in this era, would be what we call the practice of, or the use of purity laws. The practice of what foods you ate and didn't eat, and so forth. But before I do that, I'd like to just begin with putting Jesus in his rightful place, by which I mean something about the geographical dimension of Jesus's, what we might think of as his childhood and early life before the public ministry, although there's a very little we can say with assurance about Jesus, but I wanted to pick up, make a transition from last night for those, or no, it was 2 days ago, and whatever, I don't even know what day of the week it is. I think it's Friday. I don't usually teach on Friday nights. It does seem a little bizarre, doesn't it?
Yes.
But it's fine. So, for those of you who just need a little refresher course, and we can all, I think, spend some time reflecting on the fact that Jesus originates from the north part of Palestine. Palestine is the Roman name for this country at this period, since it's ruled by the Roman Empire. And he comes from this little village of Nazareth. Estimates a population in Nazareth about under 500. I told the group the other night, I've read this estimate, it's 480 people. Now, how they derived it, 480, not 479 or 481, you know. But at any rate, it's about this, it's a little bit bigger than Holden Village, and about 60 acres. So he didn't come from a very prominent sort of place. The big city is Jerusalem, which is in the area called Judea. Bethlehem, not so far down the road from Jerusalem. Palestine or Israel is sort of easy to topographically because there's kind of one major river, if you can call the Jordan a major river. It's their major river. That creek out there is about the size of the Jordan and a lot cleaner in many places. You have a little lake up here, Pula, but more important, the Sea of Galilee, which, you know, this looks pretty good size compared to Lake Chelan, which is about 55 miles. I think, I'm trying to remember, I'm notoriously bad on facts, but insofar as my memory is, I think the Sea of Galilee is about 5 miles long. So it's a real mini version of Lake Chelan. It's a little wider, but not a whole lot. And then the Jordan continues on and goes into the Dead Sea, which is one of the lowest, the bottom of the Dead Sea is one of the lowest points on Earth. And Jerusalem, by the way, is about 2,000 feet above sea level. So it's not so far to drive from the Dead Sea to Jerusalem, but it's a pretty steady kind of ascent. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, when you went to Jerusalem, you always go up to Jerusalem, because you have to ascend the, you know, sort of Mount Zion. It's, if you come even from the north, you still go up to Jerusalem. Now, again, the group that was here last time, we sorted out some of the rulers, not because I think names and dates are so crucial, but because at the time of the life of Jesus, this country is divided into three basic areas. And the politics differ a little bit depending where you live. So Jesus happens to live in the Galilee, which is ruled by one of the surviving sons of Herod, so-called the Great. Now, Herod wasn't so great if you were in his family. He did murder three of his sons and his wife and brother-in-law and so forth. He had a nasty temper. But at any rate, and he has a long reign. He is the ruler of Galilee for some 43 years. And it's under Herod Antipas that John the Baptist loses his head. Literally, and Jesus refers to him as that fox. And Galilee at this time can be described as a repressive state, repressive Roman province, but flourishing. Trade was pretty good. Herod Antipas liked to build, and he built two big cities, Sepphoris and Tiberias, and this is only about 3 miles from Nazareth. So when these cities were being built, the economy was really good because construction contributes to a healthy economy. So Herod Antipas' motto was, it's the economy stupid. No, and I think this is important. We talk about Jesus and the marginal and so forth. Jesus did, I mean, it wasn't the awful grinding, like, all of us, I think, would have found first century Nazareth or any other place, probably, I don't know, really primitive by our standards. I mean, I think there's no question. But the poverty that we talk about, say, in Galilee in the first century, was for the most part not a grinding poverty. It's a very rich, fertile area up here, particularly this lower area of Galilee. And farmers, you know, made it all right, unless it was a bad year in terms of the crops. The taxes were fairly high, probably about 40% of your income. And if there was some major disaster, then things were very difficult. But by and large, the poverty, I guess I would call a very simple life. And to say that they were repressed by the ruler was pretty much, democracy was not a big feature at this time. And so most people were repressed by the rulers. But this is, and there was a lot of trade between the cities and the rural areas. And a lot of coming and going. There's a lot of sophistication in these towns. So sometimes, you know, we present, you know, if you remember, Jesus recruits many of the 12 from around this area, from the Sea of Galilee. And sometimes we present them as real country bumpkins. And of course, we have this memory that we did have a distinctive accent if you lived in Galilee, especially in Nazareth. But they were country bumpkins. There was, just because you live in a rural area to begin with, you're not a bumpkin. And secondly, Nazareth is 3 miles down the road from a very major city that had a lot of Greek influence, a lot of Hellenistic population. And there was a fair amount of trade between Jews and Gentiles. So Jesus did a lot of, and there was another big city up here, Tiberias. Now Jesus seems, however, these names barely, Horace never even appears in the name of the New Testament. And Tiberias, I'm not sure it makes it easier. It might be mentioned somewhere at the moment. I can't come up with the reference. So it's interesting that Jesus doesn't have much interest in these bigger places. He does, however, spend most of his ministry around here in Capernaum and Bethsaida and some of these other cities. You've heard of Mary of Magdala? The town of Magdala is about right here. Well, more or less. And, when we talk about the Sermon on the Mount, we don't actually know where this happened, but those of you who have been to Israel know that there's a beautiful place called the Mount of the Beatitudes, a lovely little church up there, kind of a hostel. And I always say Jesus didn't preach the Sermon on the Mount there. He should have, because it's such a lovely spot. You know, looking right down, it's not so far from here, looking right down on the Sea of Galilee. Now, when Jesus would have gone up to Jerusalem, even though he's going south, he would have had to pass through some hostile territory here, the territory of Samaria. And we don't know how often he goes to Jerusalem in the public ministry. In some Gospels, it seems like he makes this one major trip, but in the fourth Gospel, in John's Gospel, he goes 3 times. In general, Galileans had a more stable government than did the people in Judea, and they had less connection to the temple. So Jerusalem is not just the sort of the political center in many respects, it's where the temple is, and I want to keep coming back to this. And maybe I could just pose this question so you can get into this immediately. And I'm not going to ask for answers, I'm just going to kind of put the question out here. Have any of you ever felt alienated or critical of the liturgy or the worship, style of worship in your denomination or in your congregation? Or have you ever felt alienated, say, from some national board of your church or from some ruling group in your church? I'm glad at least so when I talk today about different attitudes toward the temple or whatever, you have to understand that, you know, just as we, you know, if you've ever come out of a worship service, out of a liturgy, and said, oh, Now, that's it. I am not going back to that church. Now, I've never had this experience.
No.
That's it. I've had it. You know, it's dead or it's whatever, it's whatever. It's, you know, they're all... Well, that was true of first century Palestine. It's probably true of every religious group, right?
Mm-hmm.
But here's one of the problems, that when we hear criticisms of Jewish worship, we then generalize that that's the way it was, that all Jews were alienated from the temple or whatever, and the temple was a terrible place, and it was all, all ritualism. See, this is very often what we do to the other tradition. We have ritual, you have ritualism. Right? Okay. So, let me then start a little bit then with having put Jesus in his geographic place. Start with a word then about Jesus and the Sabbath. Now, I don't know what I thought about and are trying to take some time for discussion here. Maybe I'll just sort of throw this out. If you had to answer this question, when you think back on the Gospels, what impression do you have about Jesus and the Sabbath? Do any texts come to mind? Now, this is not a Bible class where you have to cite chapter and verse. If you have a Bible with you, it's not cheating to look in the text.
Sabbath is made for man.
Okay, Sabbath is made for man and not...
Being with his disciples and allowing them to pick the grain.
Okay, they're walking through the grain field, and they're hungry, so they pluck a little grain, and the old Pharisees call attention to the fact that they have abrogated the Sabbath law.
By the third chapter in Mark, he's broken the Sabbath three times, and the Pharisees want to kill him.
Okay, so one of the ways in which Jesus is shown as over against the Pharisees is in relationship to the Sabbath.
He seemed to particularly like to heal on the Sabbath.
Aha, that. And what was the problem there?
Work.
Yeah, okay, so.
And also other.
Okay.
Don't you suppose then Jesus, I mean, he would have taken the Sabbath day when he had the opportunity?
Well, I think that's a very good comment, but for the moment, I'm just trying to get out what we kind of remember. This is a terrific group in terms of knowledge of texts. Anything else come to mind? Actually, we had it yesterday. I think it was yesterday again, the Jubilee. And Jesus is in the synagogue proclaiming the text. But I think it's not actually, I think it's quite characteristic of us that what we remember is that Jesus was involved in a lot of controversies about the Sabbath. We tend not to remember that he's shown by Luke as going to the synagogue and standing up and reading the scroll. Of course, the rest of that text that we didn't read, he gets driven out of town because what he preaches is not so well received. Okay? Now, let's see if we can undo some of our problems about the Sabbath. One of the things, I know that I probably grew up hearing, I don't know that it was a real serious thing in my life, but that the Jews had all these rules and regulations about what you could and couldn't do on the Sabbath. Not anybody else did that along the way. And so what Jesus did, and of course that gospel text about the Sabbath is made for human beings, show Jesus as humanizing the Sabbath and making it possible for us to practice it. Now, there was once a time in many Christian denominations when, in fact, Sabbath, I don't know, anybody in here grew up in a family where you had pretty strict the word strict has a bad connotation, where you have very clearly delineated ways of keeping the Sabbath. Do you want to share a little bit about what you could and couldn't do? Or?
We really wanted to work on Sunday at the shopping center, and my father really had troubles with that. He had to pray about it, and we had family discussion, and it was a really big thing to allow us to, go to work. And it was like, well, we're going to go to church, we'll still have dinner as a family, and then, we'll go into work. So.
See, I'm actually old enough to remember that there was a time when stores
were closed on Sunday.
This was a big thing.
I'm almost pre-mall.
Yeah.
That's like that. But the time dinosaurs. That was pretty small ears. I remember arguing with them. Actually, I didn't grow up in a family that was terribly religious, but my mother, we was this thing about working on Sunday.
Jews down the street, too.
Okay. And I remember arguing with my mother, because, you know, we didn't do certain work, but we didn't do washing and ironing in those days on Sunday.
No.
But I could do my homework. And I remember arguing with my mother that that was work. And that was one of those things, because I said so. My mother didn't want to do a theological debate with me. She just wanted to do your homework, kid. But anyway. Anybody else? Now, one of the things that happens, if you read the chapter in Practicing Our Faith, Dorothy gives a few suggestions about things. Now, she's not trying to make these normative for everybody, but, you know, here are some things that she has found helpful not to do on the Sabbath. I think not to do things concerned with money, you know, not to, you know, that's not the day to go over your accounts. It's not the day to do a lot of high finance. Shopping. You know, that she's not trying to say, if you go to the mall all day long, you are a terrible sinner. But she is trying to say that we need to draw some boundaries in life, and there's some things that we might do, not do on the Sabbath for the sake of not getting ourselves concerned about the things that we have to do from day to day. If you haven't read that chapter on the Sabbath, it's a wonderful one. Now, the thing I'd like to come back to is that if a religious community, whether it's a denomination or a Christian community as a whole or a local congregation or a family, if you decide that you will keep the obligation of Sabbath, because if you recall, it happens to be one of the Ten Commandments. It's interesting, we don't feel free, I think, to dispense with the prohibition against adultery. I'm not saying it doesn't ever happen, but we at least recognize that it's not really a good thing. Okay? I mean, you know, most people don't boast of it, at least they call themselves Christians. But we do tend not to think of the Sabbath keeping as an obligation. Right? Now, if you want to keep it as an obligation, you have to have, whether it's in your family or whatever the group is, you have to have some things. This is what we do, and this is what we don't do on the Sabbath. Otherwise, right? You can't keep it as a practice. Because a practice comes down, you know, as they say, God is in the details. So if you just say, well, I'm keeping the Sabbath, I've got to make sure my checkbook balances. And then I've got to check on my money market loans, or, you know, money market accounts, you know, all the money. I have so much money, there isn't a single day of the week that I can't, you know, really study the stock market and see how I've done. And I know it's a big problem for most people come to hold in this on and on. And so what happens, of course, is that we're just as frenetic at the end of a Sunday as we were any other day, because even though we intended to keep the Sabbath, everything else impinged. So you almost have to say, all right, I got to make myself some rules. Like, I have a rule now for myself. And I don't, if I have to, you know, I don't do my professional work on Sundays. I don't go to the computer and sit and write, or I don't prepare my classes, or, you know, unless I'm, you know, if I'm desperate, then I figure, you know, hey. It's either that or the psychiatric hospital. So, and that actually has really been very helpful to me, because what happens is I don't feel like I'm working, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I like to cook. So on Sundays, I might do some cooking that I, you know, have, because I have more time. And I actually even like, I really have a sick mind. I like housework. Because see, I like results. The room's clean, you clean it, and you see the results. So if I happen to throw some laundry in and, you know, do some cooking or whatever on Sunday, that's for me recreating. For somebody else who hates to cook, cooking on the Sabbath is oppressive. So you shouldn't do it if you can avoid, you know, okay. So now, I know I'm kind of taking a long time to get there, but I want you to understand that a religious community, groups are going to say, okay, for us, these are out and these are in. And another group will say, oh, no, no, no. these are in and these are out. And that's how it was in the first century, that one of the controversies among Jews was what you could and couldn't do on the Sabbath. So when Jesus makes this norm of, you know, about, well, you know, if my disciples are going through a grain field and they're hungry, one of the texts for this is in Matthew 12, if they're hungry and they're going through the grain field, then they can eat, because God is merciful. And a merciful God would have people eat. But he's not doing an anti-Jewish thing. He's doing a Jewish thing. He's interpreting what the obligation is to keep covenant. Or same thing about healing on the Sabbath. Now, how do we know this? Well, in 1947, these manuscripts were found at this godforsaken hot spot at the north end of the Dead Sea called Qumran. And these texts are called the Dead Sea Scrolls, which they didn't have labeled and called that. Found in these caves, when you go through the Dead Sea, you see where the caves were. You couldn't pay me enough to go crawl into these caves and way high and so forth. And they found all this literature from one group of Jews. They probably were sort of one end of the spectrum, probably called the Essenes. It's a lot of controversy about this. And we know how they kept the Sabbath. And when Jesus, you remember the text in the Gospels where Jesus is talking about, it actually has to do also in the 12th chapter of Matthew, where Jesus is talking about curing the man with the withered arm. Well, let me, unfortunately, we're not in the room of the Bibles tonight, so we have to, but trust me, this is, it's in the, I'm not reading this up here, it's actually in the Gospel. Okay. This is Matthew 12:9. He left that place, this is the second controversy with the Pharisees about the, and entered their synagogue. So this must be an assembly place that's sort of well known for its association with Pharisees. A man was there with a withered hand, and they asked him, is it lawful to cure on the Sabbath? One of the many texts that you mentioned here. And of course, worse yet, the editorial is, so that they might accuse him. So it's not even a genuine question. He said to them, now notice how Jesus doesn't really answer the question, which just proves he's a Jew. suppose one of you has only one sheep and it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will you not lay hold of it and lift it out? How much more valuable is a human being than a sheep? So it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. Then it continues, he said to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out, and it was restored as sound as the other. But the Pharisees went out and conspired against him how to destroy him. Well, one of the problems is probably the Pharisees did not have an especially stringent interpretation of the Sabbath. It seems that it was more like what Jesus was trying to preach. But we know from the texts that were found at the Dead Sea that in the Essene community, so there's a specific prohibition, I won't read you all of it, but there were all these things that you couldn't do on the Sabbath, and one of them was, if your animal went into a pit, you had to wait until the end of the Sabbath. And there are a number of things. My favorite line is, this is not written in inclusive language. They didn't think a lot about that back in the first century. There's one, no man shall carry perfumes on himself while coming and going at the Sabbath. So, you know, now here's a real question. If you were a modern day Essene, could you use aftershave? he shall neither lift sand nor dust in his dwelling.
No house cleaning.
No house cleaning, good. That's exactly it. No one shall chide his manservant or his maidservant in labor and so on and so forth. You can't eat anything except that was prepared. You can't drink except in the camp. Anyway, it goes on and on about all the things you can't do. And then it says specifically here, no one shall assist a beast to give birth on the Sabbath day. And if it should fall into a cistern or pit, he shall not lift it out on the Sabbath. So what Jesus is really doing in this text, or at least Jesus that Matthew is showing us here, he's disagreeing with the Essenes. He is not disagreeing with all Jews about keeping the Sabbath. The Essenes were almost, by the way, if you do any of these things wrong, they live in this community at Qumran, if you do any of these things wrong, then you're sort of put on probation, as it were, and if you're healed of your error, you will be kept in custody for 7 years, and then at the end of that, you get to appear before the assembly. I don't think I have a call. I would have had a call to be someone at Essen. But it's even worse. There's another text that comes from the same era called the Book of Jubilees. That's not related to Cherry's Jubilee, but it's not a text that's in the canon of anybody's Bible, but it's a very interesting piece of literature because it tells us how another group of Jews, we don't know who, thought about the Sabbath. And again, there are all kinds of things you don't do in the Sabbath, and then the ending is, and if you do any of these things, you shall die. Now, I think that would have made for a fairly small community after a while. So I think what you can say is that whoever wrote the Book of Jubilees, you know, maybe it represents 20 people, who knows? And the Essenes are kind of one end of the spectrum. They are so concerned about the way the Sabbath is not being kept that they have got all kinds of boundaries around it. And then you have Jesus. He's not the other end, because he's not saying that Sabbath keeping is unimportant, but the way that the Gospels show us, he is trying to correct probably the kind of interpretations that come from a literary elite like the Essenes and whoever wrote the Book of Jubilees. But by the time that the New Testament gets written, there aren't any more Essenes, because they all died or disappeared in the civil war between 66 and 70, between the Jewish revolt against Rome, and they lost. And Jerusalem was destroyed, and the monastery, the place where they lived at Qumran was also destroyed. So the gospel writers attribute the controversy to the Pharisees rather than to Jesus with the Essenes. But I want just to repeat the important point. This is not a matter of Jesus versus Judaism. The characteristic of Jesus was underlining the fact that Sabbath keeping is meant to enhance our humanity. Not against the Sabbath, and certainly not against Jewish ways of keeping Sabbath. Let me just stop there for a moment. Would anybody like to comment or question or puzzle out a little bit what the larger point is here? Yes.
Well, I mean, I always try to explain this, going to the one quote that someone else mentioned that, you know, not inclusive, but, you know, that the Sabbath is made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And in there, Jesus isn't questioning the value of the Sabbath. In fact, he's reinforcing it.
Right.
But the whole point is that, you know, you don't make rules for the sake of rules, but a rule isn't helping anybody. I mean, it's a little radically implication that if the rule isn't helping anybody, then it's okay to break it. Which, you know, or whose rules, who's making the rules.
Right.
It's
wide open. Communities have come up with certain norms, and then, you know, Jesus is saying, well, in our community, we don't keep it that way. Which is actually how it works in Christian communities and families and so forth, too. Now, there's a wonderful book that I wished I'd thought, you know, when I was ordering books for this class, to include for the bookstore, but I didn't, so I'll just tell you about it. It's called The Shadow of the Galilean.
Yeah.
It's a great book.
Yeah.
I once used it in an undergraduate class, and do you know that they volunteered and said to me, that was a great book. And you know, when you teach theology, you don't get too many, that was a great book. But anyway, so, at any rate, it's a work of what the author calls narrative exegesis. That is, it's a way of reading the text through story. If I say it's fictional, you might get the wrong impression, because it's done by a really fine biblical scholar, whose last name is Tyson, T-H-E-I-S-S-E-N, The Shadow of the Galilean. And he takes what he knows about the first century world, and then he develops these characters who illustrate various points. And there's this wonderful exchange between one of his characters, whose name is Gamaliel, who is a Pharisee, which if you know the Acts of the Apostles and you know, Paul's autobiography that he gives, you know, he's educated under Gamaliel. And So, and he has this exchange about from Gamaliel with this young Jewish boy from Sepphoris up here, who's trying to figure out who Jesus is. So first he underlines the value of the Sabbath. So this is, we can't say this is exactly how the Pharisees thought, but this seems to me to be a very responsible inference. He says, see how other people live. They don't have a Sabbath. They have only sacrificial festivals to the gods. Count the number of those in a year. Perhaps 20 days, maybe 30, but no more. Ordinary people work most days of the year. Only rarely can they enjoy the rest which landowners and the powerful take for granted. But it's different for us Jews. We celebrate the Sabbath 52 times a year, not only to the nobility and rich. So do ordinary people, even servants and slaves. And in addition to these 52 Sabbaths, there are festivals. So this is something, this is a radical thing in Judaism. No one, even your animals, is supposed to work on the Sabbath. And then he's asked in this dialogue, does he think people like Jesus undermine the Sabbath? And his response is great. He doesn't do it deliberately. On the contrary, the rich and powerful find little support from him. But he doesn't think enough. His example could become popular. It could become the fashion to treat the prohibition against working on the Sabbath lightly. Others could exploit it for their own ends. He thinks too little of the consequences. He doesn't see that any breach of the Sabbath regulations could, in due course, lead to our living like Gentiles. Now, this is not, we do not have this as a direct quote from a historical Pharisee. But I do think it could show you how two groups of Jews who actually think quite alike about the Sabbath could still disagree with how rigorously you have to keep to the boundaries that the community has established. I don't know, maybe in your own denomination or your local congregation, maybe people differ on how they read how we should live the Christian life. So what I'm trying to do in connection with the theme is to show you that on this practice of Sabbath keeping, within the Jewish world of the first century Palestine, there was quite a variation on how you kept Sabbath, what the right way was. It's very warm in here, and I have sat in these chairs, and I'm going to suggest that a little 30-second stand-up break might ameliorate some of their effects. I promise you two more practices to talk about, and I think it's not realistic. You want to talk about Jesus in the temple or Jesus in purity laws?
Temple.
Okay, the temple. All right. Remember I asked you at the beginning to think about whether you ever had the experience of feeling alienated from either the religious establishment of your denomination, or, you know, you ever left a worship service saying, that's it, I'm not going back to this church. Got a little disgusted. Okay, same thing in first century Judaism. There was, the temple was in Jerusalem, and it was a magnificent spot in Jesus' day, particularly because the ruler who had died just before Jesus was born, or just as Jesus was born, had remodeled it. And now there's a fact I remember. The platform that he remodeled was 172,000 square feet. It was just a magnificent sight. And, you know, today when we see Jews pictured praying before the wall, the Western Wall, that was just a retaining wall for that platform, the western part of the retaining wall. And some of the stones just in that retaining wall weigh 80 tons. So it was a magnificent sight. And why did you go to the temple? Well, you went to the temple primarily to offer sacrifice. Now, here's where we also have problems being moderns. You know, offering pigeons and geese and other animals just doesn't strike us as something. Yeah, it kind of gives you the willies, right? I mean, I can't imagine it, all right? And that's what I first have to say, all right, here's a problem I have. I'm a failure with the imagination. I just can't quite get into sacrifice because it's not part of our culture. But you have to say, in the first century, this was part of Jewish culture and it was a part of many ancient cultures. So we have to kind of step back and say, gee, I could be a little ethnocentric here, right? Or I could be imposing my modern mentality on the first century. So you went, and these were commanded, by the way, various kinds of sacrifices for various things, not all of which, by the way, had to do with sin. They also had to do with sort of coming back to the community, as it were, after some experience. For instance, when there was a discharge of a hemorrhage or menstruation or whatever, that you had to, it wasn't because you did something dirty or sex was bad and they were all narrow-minded and they make the rest of us look pretty good, but because blood was so primordial that when there had been a flow of blood, you had to recognize that you had this, you had touched into the primordial, and you had to go through some ritual in order to sort of be taken back into the ordinary community. Not that the community was going to reject you, but that it was a recognition that you'd had this very powerful kind of experience. So people went and they offered sacrifice for various things, I mean, personal things that happened in their own lives, and of course at certain seasons, festival seasons, probably several times a year, even the people, maybe they only came once, we don't know for sure, but they came for all the way from Galilee to Jerusalem to offer sacrifice. Now again, I told the people the other night that this sounds, and this is the view of Judaism we always hear, they all went up to the temple and Jesus is kind of one big happy family there. No, like in every group, there are people who are already alienated from the temple. One is this group down at Qumran. They say some exceedingly nasty things about the priests in Jerusalem. They consider that this whole priesthood is corrupt, and they will have nothing to do with them, and they have their own liturgical calendar. The Samaritans, by the way, also are alienated from some other Jews, and they have an even more practical solution. They have their own temple, their own site of worship at Mount Gerizim. So we've already got variations on the theme. And as in any Christian tradition, criticism of worship sometimes happens by the people who care the most. Now, I feel very free to criticize my own tradition, which is so, okay, I'm Catholic. When I go to Mass, go to Eucharist, and it is done sloppily or absent-mindedly or, you know, I get angry. I live one block from a local parish, and I won't go there because it's so awful. I mean, all the things are done right or whatever, but there's no life. So I go 60 blocks in order to, I mean, not so far really, it sounds like I really, you know, have to travel, you know, big deal. But that is really important to me to find a place where, like, now, I think you could say if I'm critical of the liturgy at the local parish, it's not because I don't care, but because I do care. So, what again, I'm trying to say, because we inherited so many views about the temple and how, you know, the critical sacrifices when Jesus comes along, and particularly by the time you get to the letter to the Hebrews, which is written quite late, probably in the first century, Jewish worship is seen as, you know, there's this terrible contrast between the high priest, he goes in and he continually offers sacrifice, whereas Jesus, our high priest, you know, sacrifice once for all, and there's not really forgiveness of sins in the temple, and there is here. Well, first of all, it comes out of the Greek world. The Greeks weren't so into sacrifice and so forth. But I think that you should see when that, you know, what's the one text everybody remembers about Jesus in the temple?
Getting the money changers,
right? So again, we generalize. The whole thing was corrupt at the temple. Well, first of all, remember people are commanded. You know, the scriptures still are operative among these people, and they're commanded in the book of Leviticus to offer certain kinds of sacrifice. And I told you that, you know, you've got these different areas, there's still another area in here, and they're all under different rulers, and they have different coins. And also many Jews live outside of Palestine in the first century. They live in Rome or Antioch or Ephesus or Alexandria or wherever. And when they come, they have to have their money changed. Right? You know, if you go to Canada, And they love to get our bills right now because the U.S. dollar is doing so well again. But you can't, you know, you can't just sort of walk into a restaurant and use U.S. money. Or if you, you know, now when you go to Europe and you use the euro dollar or whatever that. You know, but so money changing wasn't a bad thing. It was corrupt in and of itself. Now there's a lot of investigation about what these texts about Jesus and the money changers, which by the way occur in all four Gospels. Although it's earlier on in John and it's given a little more oomph to it. What does it really mean? Is Jesus, as one person or a number of people are arguing, is he really here playing the role of the prophet of the end times and really saying, look, even this temple, the power of this temple is very relative to the power of God. And we have, thanks to Herod the Great, we've got this magnificent site now. But don't confuse the magnificence of this site with true worship of God. And so that he is in some way acting as the prophet of the end times, or if you want to use the 50 cent word, the eschatological prophet. You just sort of drop that in conversation, basically, you think you know something. Most people don't know what it means, and they're not going to ask you anyway, so you can use it. But he's the eschatological prophet talking about the fact that the temple also is of limited time and power. And remember, when the time the Gospels are written, there is no temple because in 70, when Jerusalem was conquered by Titus and by the Roman army, that was it. Just absolutely reduced to ruins. Jerusalem was burned, Jews were exiled, and so forth. Another possibility is that Jesus is, in the mode of the classical prophets, criticizing the confusion of ritual and ritualism. Maybe people were being overcharged. You know, maybe there was graft. Hard to imagine that in our churches that something like that could ever happen. No, but it's been known to happen, right? You know, every so often you read about the person who's the bookkeeper who got rich. Episcopal Church, National Episcopal Church, just had a big problem with that recently. Now, we don't know exactly why it was that Jesus overturns these tables. It does, certainly, it's a prophetic action, but again, when you read the classical prophets, when you read Isaiah and so forth, it's very strong language about what false worship is. It is when you confuse worship of God with your voice and tongue and body and so forth with the doing of justice. That worship that does not include the doing of justice is empty ritualism. It's formalism. But remember, that critique already existed within the community. We tend sometimes to use it against the Jews. So you have Isaiah, you have Amos, you have Hosea, all of whom have, you know, just read the first chapter of the book of Isaiah. It's very strong. You know, and there the prophet speaking for God says, I hate your new moons and your festivals, your feasts. You know, it's because the people have, they're coming to worship, but they've lost the sense of the covenant. Now, do we ever have this problem in our churches?
No.
Could you tell us where you worship? Because we would like to come. Right? And a lot of, we're, Annie Dillard has this wonder, you know, the essayist and writer Annie Dillard has this wonderful thing about how the church is like a group of brainless tourists on a package tour of the absolute. We're totally upset that, you know, we're talking about, we're using these great words about God and mercy and forgiveness and reconciliation. And, you know, we're all, you know, we're thinking about, let's see, what do I have to get finished by today? Have you ever heard the gospel proclaimed, and when you sit down and listen to the sermon, you say,
what was the gospel?
Where was that gospel? Because you were wherever you were. So what I'm trying to get at is that these are human problems about worship. And when we have Jesus critical of the temple, or critical of the abuses in the temple, but that we can't draw the conclusion, therefore, Jewish worship in the first century was empty. Because if you look at it the other way, where did Jesus get his profound commitment to the marginal? Where did Jesus get his sense of intimacy with God? Where did Jesus get his commitment to nonviolence? Where did Jesus come to understand something about servant leadership? It seems to me it had to come out of the tradition. I'm not saying that it came necessarily from the temple, per se. I think that had Jesus not gone and offered sacrifice on some basis, it would have been a great oddity and would be reported to us. I think Jesus probably went to the temple. I mean, the only real connection we have with Jesus in the temple is the story in Luke from the infancy narratives in Luke, and those are probably less historically based than certain other texts. But I think we can imagine Jesus, that he probably offered sacrifice. He doesn't, however, and this goes back then, one is characteristic of Jesus of Nazareth, he doesn't really make a big thing of the temple. Worship in the temple is not central to what his idea of the renewal of Jewish life is. And in this, he probably was more like the Pharisees. We don't even know really who. It seems that the high priest was probably associated with this group called the Sadducees. We don't know that much about the Sadducees. So I think you can say that, yes, Jesus offered sacrifice. It would have been highly unusual had he not. He went to the temple. But what was really important to Jesus had to do with care for others, the justice element. And when he is critical of the temple, he is critical of people who have abused that. And one of the things that was characteristic or was true of the first century is that, in this case, in Judea, which was ruled directly by the Romans, and during Jesus' day, the infamous Pontius Pilate was Rome's man in charge. By the way, he didn't live in Jerusalem because it was too noisy and dirty and so forth. They had very good taste, these Roman governors. They lived up here on the Mediterranean in a little town of Caesarea, which Herod the Great had built. And of course, it's not so bad. But, you know, if you got Augustus Caesar ruling, it's nice that you just named your new town after the Caesar. And then he comes to Jerusalem and so forth for Passover, because it would get kind of dangerous when the population went quadruple or decreased even more than that. And the high priest had to be approved or even appointed by the Roman governor. So there was a real collusion between the Jewish establishment represented by the high priesthood and the Roman establishment. And that probably has to do then with who's responsible for the decision to crucify Jesus. That when Jesus comes to town for the Passover and there's, you know, the security is out in full measure, because insurrections did happen and they were an associated part with Galilee, it's in the interest of Pontius Pilate not to have this person, Jesus of Nazareth, whoever he is, he doesn't care about his religious views, but he's dangerous because people follow him and because he makes the little people think they're something. And if you are a despot, the last thing you want is for the little people, the marginal, the people who come from places like Nazareth, or Bethlehem, or whatever. You don't want them to have a sense of their own power. And the high priests are not so enthused about Jesus. Now, again, we can't say exactly, we don't know, we don't have text to prove this, but Jesus is presenting a view of, or an interpretation of Jewish life that has little to do with the temple. And they don't like that, right? Because we don't get your business. And maybe some of the merchant class wasn't too crazy about Jesus either, because when people came to the temple, they did a nice thing while they were in town. They spent money. You know, hotels, you know, no. It wasn't the Ramada or anything like that. So it's just about time to end, but I hope tonight that I have at least touched upon the problems that happen in when we look at texts about Sabbath keeping, or look at texts about temple worship or Jesus in the temple, that we get out of this prior conceptual framework that puts Jesus versus Judaism, or even sort of separates Jesus out here, makes him singular. For instance, when Jesus criticizes the temple, he is not singular. But his criticisms differ from some of the other groups. So Tomorrow, what I intend to do is to sort of a follow-up just to say, how did then this movement that Jesus, you know, you've got this group of people, men and women, who become disciples and follow Jesus from town to town, and whose lives are changed, how did we get from this little group that was involved with what you could call Jesus' renewal movement, trying to renew Judaism, how did we get from that to the church, to Christianity? And that's a nice, simple question that, of course, is very complex, but it's only 60 minutes.
Tomorrow,
we will solve it. And for those of you who are going on the boat tomorrow, they'll never know. I'm sorry.
Read your book.
Read my book someday, if it ever gets published. So anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you.